If you have your Bible, if you'll open up to 2 Corinthians chapter 8, please. Who all was here last week? Raise your hands. There's a bunch of you, but there's a bunch of you who weren't here. What did we talk about last week? Fill these guys in. Who was awake last week? What did we talk about? Giving. We talked about giving. 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and 9 both talk about giving. I hate having to look through these microphones, so I'm going to move this out of the way. All right. Well, last week we looked at Paul's instruction to the Corinthian church about their motives for giving. How many here last week had some previously held ideas challenged a little bit or had some stuff to think about? Anybody have any stuff to think about? Okay, cool. What we learned last week as we looked at what Paul said is that giving by grace is a willing, sacrificial act of love. It's not a command of the law. There's nothing in the New Testament that commands us in terms of giving, but it's something that wells up in the heart of the new creation that is the believer, the heart that's been changed by God. And it's not motivated by obligation. It's not motivated by law. But it's a means by which we're able to demonstrate our love for Christ by being generous the way he was generous. And so today, as Paul has explained all those things, that's kind of where he left off about pointing towards how Christ's example for us is the motive that we use for our giving. And we're going to pick up today in verse 10, right where we left off, and we're going to cover some of the guidelines and the principles of giving that Paul lays out for the Corinthian church. Also, he's laying out for us if we believe this to be God's word, so that this is something that we can take away on a practical level to begin to see this practice, this aspect of giving develop in our lives. So verse 10 of chapter 8, got a lot to cover, so I'm kind of rushing through here. He says, "And in this I give advice." In what? Well, he's talking about in this principle of giving. "It is to your advantage not only to be doing what you began and were desiring to do a year ago, but now you must also complete the doing of it. That as there was a readiness to desire it, so there may also be a completion out of what you have." All right, remember Paul's talking to them about this relief fund that he's gathering together for the church in Jerusalem. You know, they've suffered a lot of things there in Jerusalem from persecution and famine. And so they're trying to get a relief fund together to try to help those believers in Jerusalem, the poor believers. And here he's prodding them to fulfill a commitment that they made a year ago to support their brothers and sisters. And from what he says, we can derive a guideline for giving, that good intentions are good, but good intentions in and of themselves are incomplete. And Paul commands the church, he's commending them rather, that they had such good intentions. When they heard about the plight of their brothers and sisters in Jerusalem, man, they just welled up in their heart. They had good intentions, but he wants it to be more than just good intentions. Giving starts, and it must start as a reaction of the heart, a response of the heart. But that response needs to move from just that emotional response and that initial feeling there to something that has action to it. William Barclay says that the tragedy of life so often is not that we lack good intentions, but that we fail to turn them into good actions. And that's a real problem with most of us as humans. I mean, we feel good initially. We have a generous thought pop into our head, and we think, man, hey, that would be great. I want to get involved in that. I want to help there. I want to do something like that. And you know, when those thoughts pop into our head, we feel pretty good about ourselves at the same time. We think, man, that'd be great. I'd be a generous person. That'd be cool. And we enjoy that thought, and we relish that thought, and we think about how cool we are for having that thought. And that neato feeling right there in and of itself pretty much is sufficient. And then we walk away from it and completely forget about what had popped into our heads because, well, we felt good already. So what we have to remember is that good intentions are good, and it's great to have generosity jump up into our heart. We want that. That's you know, the demonstration of the new heart that God has given us. We want that popping up into our hearts and our minds. But good intentions have a few enemies that we will have to overcome in the process in order to see those good intentions turn into good actions. We'll have to overcome enemies like laziness. I mean, usually, and this is really true, I mean, just as human beings, we got to acknowledge this, that usually, you know, if we don't act on an impulse to be generous immediately, by and large, we will forget about it, and it'll just kind of dwindle away, and we'll walk away from it. We'll lose our steam. That doesn't mean that we need to become reckless at the same time, and we'll talk about that. We'll give the balance to that later on. But it means that we need to start right away implementing a means by which we can act on those good intentions. Like when we're talking about giving, if we're talking about giving on a financial level, then we need to, you know, make sure that we set that sum aside so that we can pray over it and think about what it is we're going to do with it. If we just think, oh yeah, I should do that, I should give that, and then, you know, cares of life and everything goes on in life and we'll forget about it. But if we take some action immediately, we won't. Or if it's, you know, giving involves a lot of things. Giving isn't just about finances. It's about our time. It's about our talents. So, I mean, if we don't take an immediate action, we don't, you know, think, okay, I'd like to give my time to do this or to pray for that or whatever. If we don't immediately sit down with a calendar and figure out, well, when am I going to do this? How am I going to do this? Or whatever is necessary in order to prepare the way, we're not going to end up doing it, by and large. I mean, we just have that enemy at work there, that we'll just walk away from that. And, oh, yeah, whatever. You know, it felt good at the moment, so it doesn't matter now. Another enemy that we have to face when it comes to generosity is rationalization. You know, our first impulse towards generosity, I would think, usually is spirit-led. You know, that first thing that pops into our mind, that first thing that just, you know, we're aware of something or we're just moved by in something and we just want to be generous, and that first impulse is usually by the Spirit. And then we take care of working that thing out and bringing that numbers down and stuff like that. You know, we have that, you know, that childlike impetuousness jumps into there and just says, oh, you know, like GFA comes and they're sharing with us about what it is that is going on there in the children and the schools and stuff. And so right away, you know, we think in our minds, oh man, I want to get involved in that. I want to help these kids. I want to do this. And there's an amount or whatever that pops into our head. And then the rational side of us sits that little child down and says, now let me talk to you about this for a moment. And we start working out all the numbers and we start thinking it through and doing all the rational stuff that we normally like to do with that. You know, there's a wait a minute, you know, if you support that many kids, you know, how are you gonna afford that Contour cloud pillow that they advertise on TV? I don't think you can do that. So you need to cut that number down. In fact, let's just put it off and not even think about it for a while. So you know how that goes. I mean, that's just, you know, the rationalization and a lot of different things, you know, circumstances that may vary and stuff, and we'll have a tendency to view those things. There was a guy who was walking down the street one day, and he was really suffering. He didn't have much money, and all of a sudden he looked down, and lo and behold, right before him were two $10 bills kind of crumpled up, and he picked them up, and he was so excited about it. He said, oh, this is wonderful. He just lifted his spirit so much, and he said, Lord, I'm dedicating one of these $10 bills to you, and I'm just so thankful that this has been provided. And, you know, as he's all excited about it, he's waving his hands, a gust of wind grabs that $10 bill, one of them, and it flies away and lands in the gutter, and the stream takes it right down into the sewer, and the guy goes, oh, Lord, I just lost your $10 bill. So, you know, the tendency towards rationalization sort of thing is this. Those are things that we, you know how that goes. We have to work on that. We have to be careful that good intentions, remembering that good intentions are good, but they're insufficient. They're incomplete in and of themselves without the action following through. All right, enough on that. Let's keep moving. I want to look at verse 12, and I just want to look at the very first part of it there where there's a comma. So look at verse 12. It says, he's giving his guidelines. He says, for if there is first a willing mind. And that's where I want to stop, because here we see a principle and a guideline that we need to, when it comes to giving, we need to give what we're willing to give. That's an important principle to keep in mind. And again, this would have been a perfect opportunity for Paul to jump in there and remind us that the law demands 10%, you know, of our income. But he doesn't do that, you notice. You notice that this would have been the perfect time. When he's talking about that, he could have said, remember, 10% is the tithe, and that's what you're supposed to put aside and stuff. He doesn't say that at all. He starts with this principle, if there's a willing mind. Give what you're willing to give. He doesn't say anything about a 10% tithe, and I'll tell you right now, you will search in vain through the New Testament to find any place where there's any kind of command to obey the Old Testament tithe in the New Testament. But instead, we're shown this more excellent way, this concept of giving by grace. It's a willing, remember, that's our definition for it before, it's a willing, sacrificial act of love. Being willing means we're willing to give, willing to part without, no strings attached, no expectations other than that our heart is willing to be generous and to give that and to sacrifice that. Now, the question that should guide us here is not, what am I commanded to give? And I have to say that for a lot of Christians, that's one of those things that just kind of haunts them. What's the command? What am I commanded to give in this? And that's the wrong question. It really is. It's way out of the ballpark, the wrong question. The real question, the one that really matters to God, is what am I willing? What do I want to give?
Well, Rob, if you do that, people will...
Well, tough. I mean, that's the whole point, is that God wants our hearts. God's wanting to deal with our hearts. What do I want to give? What do I want to deal with? What am I willing to part with? And this is such a good question because it's going to give us pause to examine our motives for giving. And we kind of talked about that last week. Am I giving because I feel guilty? You know, because I got to do something religious. Or am I giving because I feel obligated and condemned if I don't? Oh, I didn't give anything. I'm no good. I'm a terrible Christian. Or do I just want to be generous? Am I being coerced and manipulated by really clever salespeople disguised as preachers who are bilking me for funds? Am I doing that? Or do I just want to give? Do I just want to give because I have this heart that wants to be generous? These are good, really good questions to ask ourselves. And these kind of questions will lead us to an honest interaction with God and an honest evaluation of ourselves. Because a lot of times it's the poser at work. You know that. There's a poser at work in us who's out there doing a lot of religious stuff and looking really good to a lot of people. But we got to get past all that. We got to tear him aside. We got to get down to the meat of the matter. What do I want to give? What am I willing to give? First, there must be a willing mind. All right, picking back up there in verse 12 and on through verse 15, look at what he says here about our giving. There was a willing mind. He says, it is accepted. So this is what is acceptable according to what one has, not according to what one does not have. For I don't mean that others should be eased and you burdened, but by an equality, that now at this time your abundance may supply their lack and their abundance may also supply your lack, you know, if the case were reversed, that there may be equality. As it's written, he who gathered much had nothing left over and he who gathered little had no lack. He's pointing back to when the Israelites gathered up the manna and God sent them out. And it was a daily process. They went out every day and they gathered just what they needed and they didn't store it up. They didn't have extra left over and they didn't, nobody went without. And so, okay, Paul says we should give according here to what we have and not what we don't have. And we learn that we should give proportionally. That's a principle. It's a guideline when it comes to giving. And I don't want to keep harping on this. Maybe I do, but I want to drive this observation home that he makes no mention of a fixed percentage on income here. What a perfect opportunity he would have had to go ahead and say this. Guys, remember, there's a 10% tithe out there, and you got to make sure you do this. He never says anything like that. Nowhere in the New Testament is that ever encouraged. Why? Because Colossians 2 tells us that the Old Testament law, with all of its regulations and rules that were against us, was nailed to the cross with Christ and carried away with him. So while the Old Testament is beneficial to us in that it reveals God's righteousness and it forecasts God's big plan of restoration, we don't fully grasp the meaning of most of the New Testament without understanding the Old Testament and what it was pointing to. The regulations and the ordinances that were written against us are like a dead man hanging on the cross. You got to see it that way. And whenever we go to that cross and pull some Old Testament law off, like the tithe, let's go pull the Old Testament tithe off the cross. We're pulling a dead man off the cross and we're hanging it on the backs of the church and saying, there, don't you feel better now that you're doing what you're supposed to do? All right, is that too strong? Am I? Listen, you can feel free to disagree with me. If you're listening to me and you say, Rob, you are screwed up, that's fine. But think it all through. Give me a good reason why you disagree with me. Go through and look at this. You know, understand what is being said there. Don't just come up with the flimsy argument that this is tradition. Well, this is what we've always done, because just because a lot of people are doing this is what we've always done doesn't necessarily validate the thing. You know, somebody will say, well but Rob, you know, tithing, that predates the law. It, you know, Abraham, he went and tithed to Melchizedek. He gave 10%. So you see, it started before the law. It extends beyond the law. That's the tithe. That's the way it's supposed to be. And that would be a really interesting argument had it not been the fact that Abraham was circumcised also way before the law. And so, you know, follow that logic through. You know, what does the New Testament say about circumcision? Yeah, well, that's talking about something else. We're talking about money. Yeah, that's the whole point. Listen, the principle that we find in the New Testament is proportional giving. That's the guideline of the New Testament. Proportional to what? Well, to actual income, not some hope or expected windfall, but proportional to actual income, the actual surplus of what one has. It isn't supposed to. Now, carefully listen to what I'm saying here. He says, I'm asking you to give according to what you have, not what you don't have, proportional to your income. what is necessary income is not supposed to be the thing that we're giving. What? What are you saying? What's necessary income? Well, following what we see established through most of the biblical revelation and the writings of the New Testament church, of the early church rather, necessary income is that which provides food and shelter and clothing. And of course, in a consumerist culture like ours, it gets far more complex than that, you know, because most of us are up to debt to our eyeballs because we had to have a thigh master to feel complete. So now we have obligations of debt to consider as well, money that we've borrowed from other sources that we're going to have to pay back, which is, honestly, it's too bad. And I do not believe that it's sin to have debt. I don't believe that, but I believe it would be a good principle for a Christian to make a plan to work towards getting out of debt in order to be more of a blessing to those that are in need so we can be a blessing to others. Now, the Macedonian church he talked about last time gave more than they were able, as Paul said, but it was more of an exception than the rule. He was, you know, Paul reminds them here, here's the principle, the guidelines that you need to use. He says, give what you have, not what you don't have. It's so important to remember. Honestly, you know, it sounds weird, but we've had to stop more than one person from giving into the offerings here because, you know, they're giving in the offerings, but they can't pay their bills. You know, you don't do that. Someone who has, you know, someone who's 2 months behind on an electric bill has no business. Does this sound really weird? I hope it doesn't freak you out, but has no business putting money over there in those offering boxes. I'm not trying to be harsh or anything. I'm not trying to offend. It's just that's unethical, in my opinion. I mean, as Christians, we've committed to pay for services, or we've borrowed money for a home. And if we take the money that should be going to making that commitment good and giving it away, we're giving someone else's money away without their permission or their consent. And we got to be careful about that kind of stuff. You know, that's just, I don't believe that's right. We've got to forget all that hype that comes out on a regular basis out of our TV that says, you know, give till it hurts and God will return it 100-fold. Listen, that whole thing about the 100-fold, that is a poor hermeneutic of what Jesus said in the passage where he said it, and it's a faulty extrapolation of the principle. How many dear saints have I known who have followed that principle and bought into that sales pitch and forsook their financial obligations and gave extravagantly to some ministry every day, going out to their mailbox looking for the magic check that's going to show up and pay everything off, and their testimony then becomes besmirched because they've had to renege on financial obligations that they've made. It's just crazy. Just forget that noise. We've got to get real when it comes to this. The problem is way too many have over-mysticized this thing and turned it into this ambiguous, nebulous thing. Like, we're so afraid, you know, I gotta do this. I gotta give my money. I gotta do whatever. Paul gets very real and gets very practical here. And he says, listen, I'm just telling you, give what you have, not what you don't have. Just follow that principle. It's very simple that way. But again, still being honest. And we got to be honest about this. We as Americans have more disposable income than any other people on the planet when it comes to that kind of stuff. And I want you to, at some point when you get a chance, go to a website called globalrichlist.com. I'll put it up there and you can write it down. Go there sometime and type in your annual income. Because what it does is it calculates your annual income based on the rest of the world. I typed in an income of $20,000. Now, that's not my income, so don't worry or anything. But it's considered poverty level here in the United States. That's considered poverty level. If you make $20,000 a year, you're in poverty. And I typed that number in to the Global Rich List, and it placed a person with $20,000 a year in the top 11% of the richest people on the planet. There are over 5 billion people poorer than someone who's considered poverty level here in the United States. So, you know, my adamant rant about giving according to what you have is still relative. And please don't use that as an excuse then. Obviously, if you're in a position where you're not able to pay your bills, then you want to pay those bills and be a good witness and a good steward that way. But there's a lot of things that we think make us poor that really isn't. You know, we don't want to use an excuse saying, well, you know, I still got to buy that hair that comes in a spray can and stuff. I'm not sure I can afford to give this week or whatever. You know, the poor widow that Jesus pointed out, the poor widow that Jesus pointed out who just gave a penny while all the rich folks were going through and doing all that. You know, it doesn't take riches to be generous. It just takes a willing heart. And that's what's delightful to God. And that's what this is all about. It's not about sums or amounts. It's about what is delightful to God, what's acceptable to Him. And our hearts being generous is what is acceptable to Him. That's what He wants. He just wants that in our hearts, that realization that we don't have to trust in money. We don't have to place our trust here in the systems of this world to find fulfillment or anything like that. We can be fulfilled in knowing Christ, and we can be generous with even a little if that's all we have. And that's why, you know, and that's why Paul is saying this. He's not looking, he says, he's not trying to make the Corinthians poor in order to make the Jerusalem Christians rich, but he's looking for, and it says equality, a better word for it would have been equity. Not equality, because that comes across poorly in the translation. It sounds like socialism or something. That's not what he's doing. Equity, that is, it's only fair, he's saying, that you Corinthians, when you have more, supply to the Jerusalem Christians who don't have anything, when they're in need. And that's why we encourage being generous, you know, to missions and things like that. Just like we heard this morning of our brothers and sisters in Pakistan who have nothing. It's important for us to remember that and be generous out of the hearts that God has given us and support our brothers and sisters globally, you know, supplying for those who lack. All right, still got a lot to cover, so let's keep going here. Verse 16, I'm going to try to talk fast, but it's probably going to make me screw up, so maybe I won't talk fast and you'll just forgive me today. But verse 16, he says, "But thanks be to God who puts the same earnest care for you in the heart of Titus, for he not only accepted the exhortation, but being more diligent, he went to you of his own accord. And we've sent with him a brother whose praise in this in the gospel is throughout all the churches. And not only that, but who has also was also chosen by the churches to travel with us in this gift, which is administered by us to the glory of the Lord himself, and to show your ready mind, avoiding this, that anyone should blame us in this lavish gift, which is administered by us, providing honorable things not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. We've sent with them our brother, whom we've often proved diligent in many things, but now much more diligent because of the great confidence in which we have in you. If anyone inquires about Titus, he's my partner and fellow worker concerning you. And if our brethren are inquired about, they're messengers of the churches, the glory of Christ. Therefore, show to them before the churches the proof of your love and the boasting and of our boasting on your behalf." Okay, this is all just stuff that's pertaining to them. He's talking about how he's going to send Titus there, and they're going to gather it up. And so, you know, if there's any inquiry, what's this all about? Why are we doing this? Who are we sending? He's just kind of giving their credentials and what that's, you know, who it is that's coming. Let's keep going here. Chapter 9, verses 1 through 5. He says, "Now concerning the ministering to the saints, it's superfluous for me to write to you. For I know your willingness, about which I boast of you to the Macedonians, that Achaia was ready a year ago, and your zeal has stirred up the majority." In other words, their zeal to give has stirred up everybody else in the region. "Yet I've sent the brethren, lest our boasting of you should be in vain in this respect, that, as I said, you may be ready. Lest if some Macedonians come with me and find you unprepared, we, not to mention you, should be ashamed of this confident boasting. Therefore, I thought it necessary to exhort the brethren to go to you ahead of time and prepare your generous gift beforehand, which you had previously promised, that it may be ready as a matter of generosity and not as a grudging obligation." So here we get a glimpse as to why the Macedonians, as we looked at last time, were so zealous to give. Paul's been bragging throughout the region about the generous commitment that the Corinthian church had made, and it was inspiring the Macedonians and the other people in the region there. But Paul's telling them, look, you know, you guys need to get this gift ready. I mean, you need to actually gather this thing up, because if I come here and there's Macedonians with me, we're all going to look stupid if you guys are, you know, scrounging through the couch to find some money or whatever to put this together. He says, we're going to look ridiculous after all the bragging that we've done about you. But notice that he wants them to have plenty of time to do this. He's sending this letter ahead of them. He's trying to get this message out to them. He wants them to have plenty of time. He doesn't want them to be forced or hurried, but as a matter, you know, he wants this to be a matter of honest generosity. And the guideline for us in this is that we need to be prepared in giving. I really think what you know, ends up being almost a bitter spot for us sometimes is that we are easily manipulated when it comes to money and when it comes to giving. You know, we get manipulated by preachers and things like that because we haven't given any real forethought to giving. We think about it when we're there and at the moment, you know, Gospel for Asia shows up and we're like, oh yeah. And we haven't had any real time to think these kind of things through. We haven't prepared our hearts and our minds when it comes to giving. Giving is something that we should be thinking about. And I think it's a good idea for every Christian or Christian family to sit down and figure out how much money goes through my hands every week, every month, every year. You know, what's happening here? What's happening with my income? And determine from that what we can be generous with, what we're prepared to be generous with when the time comes and the opportunity arises. And pray over an amount and find the Spirit's guiding on this. You know, Robbie and I do that on a regular basis. We pray over what it is the Lord wants us to give. We ask him for a dollar amount. And to be honest with you, we're aware of what we have and what we can be generous with, and we ask him for a dollar amount. And she and I pray separately on that. And you'd be surprised at how often it comes back with the exact same number, because it's always zero. No, I'm just kidding. But, you know, we but no, the Lord really does that. He actually moves, and we come back with the same amount. And so we have that sense of confidence. We know how the Lord has led us, and we're prepared when it comes time to be able to give. Honestly, I really think that families should include their kids in on this. That's one thing I really wish I'd have done differently when my kids were little, to include them in on how we give and to whom we give and how we determine what to give. You know, it's a good preparation for them. And, you know, when we talk about giving, we're not just talking about the offering boxes here. Obviously, you know, we determine an amount that we're going to give to that to keep the building open and have the lights on and pay for the needs of having a community gathering like this. But there's other means of giving. You know, we give to the missions and the brothers and sisters overseas. We give to those who are even within this community that we may be aware of. There's a need there, and so we do our best to take care of it, you know, in ways that it is, you know, wouldn't be known. But it's just, those are the aspects of giving. And so it's a good idea to bring our families into that, bring the children in on this so that they understand this, you know, because we train them for all these other things. We train them for, you know, how to get a credit card and how to pay bills. But we don't want to neglect this aspect of modeling this kind of training in their lives, how to live generously according to what's happened in our hearts. So if we put some forethought into giving, we're not going to be susceptible to manipulation. For a situation where somebody's, you know, pressing on us to give or whatever, we're not going to feel condemned if we don't give in a certain situation, because we've already settled that matter beforehand in our hearts. We know what the Lord's leading on this is. So we can walk away from that, you know, regardless of how much pressure comes to bear. We can walk away from it and feel solid in that, because we know how God is guiding us. Does that make sense? Do you see what I'm saying in that? Everybody, are we cool? Are we all together? Okay, good. All right, verse 6, chapter 9, verse 6. But this I say, he who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, and he who sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. And I want to include some later verses in on this as well, because the Eastern mind was real comfortable jumping back and forth from things, but as Westerners, we really want things in their categories. So let's jump down to verse 8. He says, God's able to make all grace abound toward you, that you, always having all sufficiency in all things, may have an abundance for every good work. As it's written, he has dispersed abroad, he's given to the poor, his righteousness endures forever. Now may he who supplies seed to the sower and bread for the food supply and multiply the seed you have sown and increase the fruits of your righteousness while you are enriched in everything for all generosity or liberality which causes thanksgiving through us to God. And here we see the principle that's going to guide us, and that is we will never outgive God's ability to provide for us. And just to qualify here, you read these verses, and these verses are widely abused by many. I do not believe that this is teaching give to get, the give to get mentality that so many employ. When judged by the flow of overall revelation of Scripture, we know that the only basis for God's blessing in our life is purchased by the sacrifice of Christ on the cross. God's grace is the source of all blessing that comes to us, not our works of giving. But at the same time, there is a general principle that Paul is laying out here where when we're generous, we abound in the capacity to continue on in that generosity. God provides the ability to do that. Notice he says we'll have an abundance for every good work. That is that when we give generously, God sees to it that we have the means to continue on in being generous that way, that same pattern in our lives. It's not this financial scam that so many present that, you know, you give $100, you get $100,000 in return. Actually, as you look at so many of these passages, there's nothing in the New Testament that actually even indicates that we're going to be receiving anything in kind. In other words, financial generosity does not necessarily ensure that we're going to have a monetary abundance. But this abundance that he's talking about is always couched in the idea of God's presence and God's grace in our life. Notice he says in verse 10 that God will multiply the seed you have sown and increase what? More seed, more funds, more? No, the fruits of your righteousness. In other words, the presence of God, his character is more manifest in your life because of this generosity. That's what he's talking about there. He's just saying that God's going to fill us up with himself as we give of what we have generously. But I do also believe, you know, just to counterbalance everything here, that he is indicating that God's going to care for our needs. He doesn't say, you know, he doesn't say we're going to go poor, we're going to go broke. He says it will be enriched in everything. So we don't have to live in fear that, well, you know, if I'm generous, I'm going to end up in the poorhouse or on Skid Row or something. He says, you know, he says right here, we'll be enriched in everything which causes liberality or generosity. In other words, as we give out, God's going to keep us supplied so that we can continue to live generously, so that we can continue to give and live generously. It's never with the intent or the idea that, yeah, so that you can just be filthy rich, you know, so that you can lay around and swim around in money and have as many toys as you want. It's never with that kind of concept at all. Enriched in everything, in other words, so that we can be generous and live that way. We'll never race past God in our generosity and give beyond his ability to provide for us. That's all he's trying to say there. Okay, jump back up to verse 7. He says, so let each one of us give as he purposes in his heart, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loves a cheerful giver. And here he's just restating what he's already said. It's already been established. That is that giving in the New Testament isn't a command. It's not an obligation. It's a willing, sacrificial act of love. And I love the word that he uses when he says, God loves a cheerful giver, because the word in the Greek is hilaros. And it's the root word for the English word that we use for hilarious. So God wants our giving to be a hoot. It's not supposed to be this morbid obligation, you know, I got to give now. It's nothing like that. Now, most of us, if we were going to be honest, when we talk about being generous and being, you know, getting hilarious in our giving, it sounds weird, doesn't it? But, you know, and if we were honest and we're looking at our own lives and we're thinking about the way we respond to a lot of things, we'd be saying, you know, Rob, I got a long way to go before I'm going to get to that point. I don't know about this. But again, this is where we still have to get past what has been ingrained in us for far too long. And it's one of the greatest bits of damage that's been done to us over the years as Christians. We have got to get past this sense of obligation when it comes to our giving. We've got to get past this sense that, you know, this is what I got to do. I have to do this. It's the law. It's my command. It's my obligation. I got to do it. We've got to see this. We've got to see all aspects of this when it comes to how we give within the church as an I love you, Jesus kind of thing. When we see it like that, when we're able to see it like that, get past the fog of obligation or the mystery of the whole thing and just see it as an I love you, Jesus kind of thing, it can get hilarious then. It can be something that stirs our hearts with joy. Something that fills us with delight when we're able to do it. A while back, I was with my whole family, all my kids and my wife and I, and we were going to go get something to eat. We were going to have a family dinner at one of the buffets in town. it was around Christmas time, and we had gone and bought a tree. That's hard work, and so we were all hungry afterwards. My oldest son came up to me. I was getting, you know, we were there in the buffet thing where you pay, you know, they want you to pay before you hit the trough. And so, you know, I'm dad. You know, dad just knows that he always takes care of everything. The family's all around. Dad takes care of it all. And so, you know, we get over there and I'm heading up there and I'm pulling out my wallet and looking through and, you know, and trying to calculate internally how many we've got here and blah, blah, blah. And we're getting up there to the thing, and my son, my oldest son, he had his own job. He's working and he's, you know, kind of moving out on his own and all. And he came up to me and he said, Dad, let me pay. And of course, you know, I'm dad. And so I'm thinking through, well, how much does he make an hour? No, blah, blah, blah. And I'm going, no, son, no, I'll take care of that. And all of a sudden I felt this rib this elbow in my rib. And, you know, I've been married 23 years. I know that elbow well. And I didn't even have to turn and look back. I just knew, you know, I knew what it meant even. Hey, caveman, you're missing something here. So, you know, I'm starting to look around. What am I missing? What did I screw up? What's happening here? And as I looked around, I suddenly saw my son's face. And I saw on his face just how much he really wanted to buy the family dinner. How he had the resources and he obviously, I guess he had the excess to be able to do this. And I saw it on his face. I really did. That eagerness and that desire to do it. And I, you know, of course, you know, I kicked myself internally. I'm thinking, you caveman, what did you let him buy? So I stepped aside and I'm telling you, when he went up to the register, and I kept watching him. You know, this is my son. I was watching him, and I saw it. Even as he's talking to the lady and giving the money, and he'd look back at us every once in a while, I just saw it all over his face, just this delight at being able to do that. And, you know, how do you describe what goes through a father's heart when he sees something like that in his son? I mean, you know, I'm filled with pride. But it's more than that. I mean, there's no words to wrap around that. I myself became completely delighted in his delight at being generous that way. And so then I read a verse like verse 7 here, and I wonder, what does my father feel when my heart wells up with delight to give and to be generous in that same kind of capacity? What goes on there in my father's heart? I think it's got to be kind of something like what I go through, because I'm made in his image. It's got to be something like that. And I love the thought of that. I love the thought of my father and I wrapped up in this mutual delight at being able to demonstrate love by being generous and being giving this way. So forget obligations. Forget laws. Can an obligation ever do that in your heart? Could it ever stir that kind of a thing? Forget commands that we grudgingly obey. Let's get hilarious about our giving. Let's be delighted that we're delighting our Father. And let's live in that same kind of delight. All right, I want to just finish up here what he says in the rest of the chapter here, verse 12. He says, "For the administration of this service not only supplies the needs of the saints, but also is abounding through many thanksgivings to God, while through the proof of this ministry they glorify God for the obedience of your confession to the gospel of Christ and for your liberal sharing with them and all men, and by their prayer for you who long for you because of the exceeding grace of God in you. Thanks be to God for his indescribable gift." And this is basically Paul's summary. He's saying that giving by grace results in blessings all around. This relief fund that they're giving is not only supplying for the material needs of the church in Jerusalem, but it's resulting in thanksgiving to God, a good testimony of God's work and grace at work, a demonstration of the reality of God's love, prayers for those who were generous, and this heart of gratitude in everyone for how God has made himself real through this obedience of the saints. So everyone involved in this receives from the Lord at this point. When we extract the formula of giving to get, and we extract the obligation and the law, and we bring it down to this demonstration of God's grace, everyone involved comes out blessed and rejoicing in God for his exceedingly great gift. That's a wonderful thing. So just to do my own summary, when we give by grace, we want to remember that good intentions need to be followed through with actions, with good actions. We should give only what we're willing to give. What is in my heart? What do I want to give? We should give proportionally out of what we have, not out of what we don't have, not out of necessary income. We should put forethought into our giving. So we're not going to be manipulated, but it's something that we've interacted with God about, we've prayed about, we're confident in. And we need to realize that we're never going to outgive God's ability to provide. And then let's delight in giving. And recognize that giving is a demonstration of how much we love Jesus. I love you, Jesus. That's what this is all about. It's that kind of thing. Is that cool? We're all good with that? All right, very good.